Welcome to the Sacred Body Podcast with Stacey Ramsauer. I'm your host, Stacey, and I believe that the body is a space of reverence. Whether you were talking about your body of flesh and bones that house your soul, spirit, or the body of the earth, even your body of work, I believe the body is a space of sacred connection and reflection. Until we have the capacity, the tools, the language, to relate to our body and express ourselves with ease and authenticity, our relationships and our experience of belonging here to this earth and to each other will be fractured. On this podcast, we explore the dynamics of light and darkness, pleasure and pain, and even comfort living in our own skin. I hope you enjoy. Welcome everybody to the Sacred Body Podcast. I get to have Greer Kirschenbaum here. I am really thrilled to have Greer here because it took us about 6 weeks to get this scheduled. But also your introduction came through a woman I deeply love, Britta Bushnell. And the book has been released now, right?
Yes.
It had not quite when we were first talking, but The Nurture Revolution, Grow Your Baby's Brain and Transform Their Mental Health Through the Art of Nurtured Parenting. This book is really fascinating, Greer. I've been so really lit up reading pieces of it and challenged, and I'm excited to dive in with you. And I'd love to give you the opportunity to just introduce yourself to us, your brief bio, how you got to this point of putting this work out into the world.
Thank you. Yeah. So happy to be here. So happy to connect today. I think that my interest in babies, the needs of babies, it started with my own experience as a baby. I was really high needs. The stories about me are, I could never be put down. I never slept. And on, like that. And so I was always told these stories about me, and my brother was very similar as well, and how my mom was really different than the other people around her because she was holding us, breastfeeding us very long-term, bed sharing with us. We had a family bed, and this was very different than everyone around. So I was always sort of aware of that and aware of how much I needed that as a baby. And curious about that. What does that mean about a baby, about a parent, about, you know, all of it. And I think that with also my mom's influence led me into studying neuroscience. So I volunteered in a neuroscience laboratory the year after I finished high school.
Wow.
At that point I thought I was going to be an MD. I wanted to be an MD. And so I was getting sort of experience in hospitals and research. And that led me to do a undergraduate degree in neuroscience, where I was really able to focus my interests. So I learned, how does early life experience affect how the visual system develops, how the auditory system develops, how cognitive systems develop, and how learning and memory develops, which is a big topic for me. Just loved it. I think in those years I was like, I had also done other volunteering in hospitals, and I was sort of like, I want to do this research. I love this the research kind of arm. So, after that, I did a PhD in neuroscience and medical science, continuing in the same realm of early life experience, mental health. Didn't always get to study it as directly as I wanted to, because that's kind of how research goes. But I did as much as I could. And then I also continued as a postdoctoral fellow doing the same. So I had a lot of time conducting experiments. And the whole time I wanted to bring the power of early life experience out into the world. I didn't know how it was going to happen during those years. I remember in my PhD kind of scheming and thinking, like, and in those days I was like, oh, maybe it should be more of a sensory enrichment. And over, you know, I guess it was about 15 years of being in the lab, so much of this emotional development research came out. So how experience in early life really changes our emotional systems, our mental health, you know, and as such, our cognition, our physical health, you know, so many things. And so that it was almost not, it would almost just came to me. I was at my postdoc lab on the computer, figuring out how do I bring this information to the world. I discovered doulas and I was like, oh, I got to sign up for the next doula trip. And I did that. And then I worked as a doula and became a mom. And so over the past 10 years or so, I've been really bridging that academic background with the doula experience and figuring out how do we bring this information to families in like the most powerful way.
Yeah, that piece I think is really highlighted in your book through the way that you like demystify or like debunk these myths that are out there so saturated into our culture about how to be with babies and what is the quote unquote right thing to do and what is safe and on and on and on. So that journey is quite fascinating. And I think you've achieved something amazing with this book. Like as a doula, a former doula myself, I think that it's worth noting, like it's, your book is dense. There's a ton of science in it.
Yeah.
And it's written in, it's clearly written for families.
Absolutely.
I think it's very, yeah, it's very well structured. And then how long was this process to write your book?
I started it very quickly. I started it like as soon as I left academia.
Wow.
Yeah. I wrote a rough version of it. And then I sort of knew I needed to embody the work a lot more and, you know, have a lot more, you know, experience. So I did sort of set it aside. So I started writing it about 10 years ago, work, you know, for a while, had my own baby. And then the actual writing was about 2 years. Okay. Yeah. From beginning to end. It's funny too. It is really dense. I am so passionate about the research, and the place where it started was even more.
I bet.
It was.
Of course. I can imagine. But yeah, when you have all of this information, all this data, like you want everyone to know.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, I would love for you to define nurture. Again, the title of your book is The Nurture Revolution. And I think your definition of nurture is really beautiful. And I'd love to hear it from you.
For sure. Yeah. So it was funny. I'd read the book and in one of the drafts, I was like, I haven't defined nurture explicitly. Mm. Because it's a hard to define term, right? And I think a lot of people will have different definitions of what it is. I believe it is a physical and emotional relationship with your baby, where you're consciously in the relationship, finding the relationship and returning to the relationship, in all of a baby's states, in their states of happiness and playfulness, in their states of stress, and also in their states of sleep.
And in this book, you sort of walk folks through the role that nurture plays in brain function and development and why these first 3 years of baby's life are so critical and even pre-birth.
Yeah. Even in pregnancy as well, we can make a difference. It's amazing. The studies that we have on the effect of nurture in early life, the results are staggering. Like it's amazing how much our brains and a baby's brain can be transformed by nurture in these early years. And it's a beautiful process. It's incredible. And I just have so much vision for what can happen in our world, you know, if we were open to giving babies and parents nurturing experience in early life.
You alluded to something earlier about like sensory experiences and then of course a physical and emotional relationship with your child. So could you talk about the role of touch? Because obviously that goes into contact sleeping and all of that.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a huge part. I think before, you know, this nurture body of work had come out, you know, we already knew that sensory experience is wonderful to develop the brain, right? You know, all types of visual experience, touch, movement, you know, proprioceptive vestibular input, so important. But the nurture piece is that if sensory experience happens between a parent and a baby, if the sensory experience is, you know, not always only the mother or father or parent, but if a lot of that experience comes from the parent, something else is added into the, mm-hmm. into the baby's brain, which is transformative. And so there's a difference between a baby, you know, playing with a sensory bin on the floor. They'll love that. It's great. It's developing their brain. It's wonderful. And then if you add that social component in, right, it's different. So if their sensory experience is happening, you know, with their parent, whether touching their parent's clothes and their hair, I was just with my niece imagining her with her this morning. In terms of their brain, a lot of oxytocin,
yeah,
beautiful molecule, is released with a cascade of other hormones and neurotransmitters like dopamine, endorphins, a whole bunch. And so I call that kind of a nurture bath. So the baby's brain is sort of bathing in this beautiful cocktail of hormones that come from connecting with another person, taking in their smell, their sight, their touch. It's a very special experience for babies.
And correct me if I'm wrong, my understanding of this is that, and we can talk about the connection. I've seen a lot of folks sharing this on social media, but like implicit versus explicit memory and the significance of that. But what I hear you saying is like these early sensory experiences, when there's that added element of connection with the caregiver, this oxytocin bath, it's fair to say it's like building positive regard, like everything is connected with this ease and joy and love and support, like moving out into the world is now a safe and exciting thing to do.
Yeah, absolutely. Their stress system gets built, their relationship, you know, the foundation of relationships.
Yeah.
So many critical parts. And even just thinking to playing with my niece this morning, she's about eight or nine months. She was on the floor with her toys and she was like, calling for us. She's like, come on, someone play with me, you know, just with her little noises. And she was really happy to play with her toys on her own, but she really wanted to just keep looking to me to say like, look, you know, this is really amazing. This is what I'm doing. And I think that that's a huge difference, right? There's a huge difference between her playing with them on her own and then also having, you know, input from someone, and babies communicate for it, right? They're in their own language calling in caregivers to come help.
And I imagine too, having that, you know, just mirroring a positive point of contact is encouragement to keep figuring out how to speak, it's encouragement just to keep going.
Yeah, absolutely. And the, you know, one of the other big foundations, you know, I think of a nurturing relationship is having a baby feel seen by their loved ones, right? And so we do that in interactions like that too, right? Just even say to her, I see you, you're holding the yellow car. That must be so much fun.
Yeah.
It's very important. It's very important to have that experience as a baby.
I want to go in two different directions right now. I'm going to choose one and we'll come back to the other. Two of, I think, the biggest myths that you address with your work is that babies should sleep on their own and you could somehow like over cuddle a baby. There's somehow been this thing that got infused into our culture that like babies can be loved too much.
Yeah.
But the sleep thing I think is really critical. That's like a big point of contention, right?
Yeah.
So could you just share what you found, how nurture applies to sleep? And I don't know if you call it co-sleeping or contact sleeping.
Yeah, absolutely. it's really hard because there is so much messaging from experts, doctors, family members, friends, right? It's a really predominant message that parents get.
Yeah.
Don't let your baby depend on you for sleep. Don't be with them when they sleep. Make sure they're sleeping alone as fast as possible. And when we look at the neurobiology of infant sleep and parent sleep, because parents are always in the mix as well, you know, we really do see their sleep is much better supported with a lot of closeness. You know, I think parents sometimes will be okay with it. And this is like not the parents' choice. It's the society, the societal right. pressure, right? I think sometimes babies from like starting at 3 to 4 months kind of get this pressure. So in the newborn phase, they're like, oh, okay, it's a newborn. You know, maybe these rules don't apply. Even, you know, not for everyone, but then at 3 and 4 months, it sort of becomes a very abrupt change where parents, you know, move away from holding babies while they sleep, sometimes even rocking them to fall asleep. They start to encourage them to fall asleep on their own, and things like that. And it really creates a lot of struggle in the relationship.
Yeah.
Because we get these messages, don't rock them to sleep, don't feed them to sleep, don't help them to sleep, you know, leave them alone. And then we have our baby's communication in real life that's saying, feed me to sleep, that's really easy for me, rock me to sleep, you know, help me when I cry. And so parents are living with that confusion, those two really opposing messages, right? And so much of my work is encouraging parents to set aside some of those influences that are saying, you know, let your baby be independent young, and listen to their inside voice, right? Their intuitive voice, their intuition, their baby's communication and their communication to be really supportive of babies. And when that happens, that struggle disappears. And so much of this pressure can disappear, so much anxiety, sometimes depression or surrounding it, an obsessive kind of tracking of it can disappear. And parents can really relax into the relationship, knowing that by supporting their baby's sleep, their baby's probably getting better quality sleep, more sleep, and also much more nurtured sleep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can you speak to how this element of nurture, and particularly with sleep, like how is it affecting the brain?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, it's, I think we need a lot more research on it. I would love so much more. But we do have some information to start from, right? So we know when babies are sleeping close, and so, you know, in my book, I recommend either a baby sleeping in a bed sharing setup if a family meets the safety criteria for it. Because we can't just bring a baby into our bed. We have to prepare it and make sure we meet criteria for it to be safe, or to have a baby sleeping right next to a parent's bed. And so when we do that, when we know that babies sleep close, we know that our presence as a parent or caregiver lowers their stress or blunts their stress response. So their cortisol is much lower in their brain and body. And we're also increasing oxytocin. So it's the same with us as adults, right? So many adults require or prefer a bedmate, right? To sleep soundly. And it's the same effect. We have lower cortisol, higher oxytocin, and that can improve a lot of outcomes for sleep. We can fall asleep faster. We can stay asleep longer. And our brain, our sleep architecture can change as well too. So only benefits.
And you say one of the pages I have dog-eared, one of my favorite things in the book is, you know, all our other organs, you know, our liver, our heart, they're like baby version, just tiny versions of an adult heart.
Yeah.
The brain is not that. The brain is not a smaller brain. It's almost a blank slate. It's being formed through lived experience.
Mm-hmm.
That's so profound.
It is.
Because like, then that also has an impact on the function of all the organs.
Yes. I'm so happy you noticed that part. It is really important to think of that. Like the way that we care for our baby, their heart is still going to form, you know, with its genetic program, right? To sort of get larger.
And grow.
Yeah. And our brain is, you know, babies are born with nearly all of their brain cells, but they're not connected. So they need to form all of their connections, so many in the emotional brain and the parts of our brain that, you know, are responsible for both our mental health and physical health. And so the experience babies have connects their brain cells, guided both by genetics and experience, but about 50-50 input from both. Yeah. So the experience has a huge role, and yeah, it really matters. That experience in those early years really, really, really do matter. They have an impact on, you know, brain circuitry, behavior, stress, and health for life.
And the effect I'm imagining of like the limbic system to the prefrontal cortex, like how all of those things sort of interface.
Absolutely. Yes. Yes.
So I'm a somatic practitioner and I do this. I wonder if you do this as a neuroscientist, like just watch the news and attribute everything to like poor nurture in early childhood.
Yes, always.
I'm thinking about the world right now and I'm like, God, there's such low resilience. I mean, so much intolerance. And this is the generation that was like, don't touch your baby. Don't pick them up. Put them in a separate room. Let them cry.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
Yes, that is, I say that to my son all the time. He's, he says that. He's like, you're going to change the world with the, like helping the babies. And I talked to him about that, you know, when people are cutting me off in traffic and acting impulsively and, you know, all these kinds of things, I talk to him about that. I'm like, they don't have that, you know, the ability to self-regulate, to be self-aware, to reflect, right? And we do see that in so many places in the world, so many systems. Yeah, yeah.
So as I said, I'm a somatic practitioner and there's a tremendous amount of resilience in the nervous system. You know, there's a tremendous amount of plasticity there too. And I'm curious, I would love to hear you speak on that from a neuroscience perspective, because there's, you know, I was adopted at birth. So there was a lot of pre-birth trauma. There was a lot of birth trauma. There was a lot of early childhood trauma. And yeah. I was nurtured and I wasn't breastfed. I slept by myself. And I have experienced not so much with my first child, but with my second child, this feeling of like, I can't. And I'm really curious about our resilience based on the work that you've done. There's this critical period in early life, right? And then what? Like where and how can nurture factor in after the fact?
Yeah.
Those critical first years.
That's a great question. So I think the best place that we have information on it comes from studies in Romanian orphanages.
Yeah.
Because those babies also had, we don't really know about their pregnancy experience, but in their early life, in those first 3 years, they had their physical needs met. So they were fed and changed and were in comfortable cribs and things like that, but didn't have any emotional needs met. Essentially, they didn't have enough staff to be interacting and helping them with stress. And so we find the closer those babies are when they're adopted, the closer they are to being adopted at birth, the better off they do in all the measures that are available. But even with the sort of later adoptions, even if they are after 3 years old, if those babies go to families that are highly nurturing through childhood, and then through adolescence, they sort of can have a lot of plasticity happening. So a lot of the risk factors that could have happened without that low nurture experience are sort of reversed in a lot of ways, right? They become non-significant. So some of the outcomes they find, yeah, there's some emotional, you know, emotional regulation challenges, learning challenges, some motor challenges. But if, yeah, like I said, if they have that really nurturing experience through childhood and adolescence, then they, the rest of their lives, they're kind of doing as well as others in some of the specific measures that they have.
And I'm curious about the impact of like having that, those high nurture experiences through that next like big hormonal surge.
Yeah.
I imagine that makes a big difference too.
Yes. So it was the big times for emotional plasticity we know of are those first 3 years of life, adolescence, and then when we become parents.
Yeah.
Right. Those are the three big ones. Possibly menopause as well. We're not sure. That's a lot of people have kind of hinting at that as looking at some other changes. I think people anecdotally are describing that and
we need
more research. But those are other times where we can have a lot of changes as well. I'm not an expert in the adolescent time. The one resource I've looked at is Gordon Neufeld and Gabor Mate's book, to sort of continue to maintain a nurturing relationship with our children through adolescence. And then as parents, so many of the brain changes we have can happen while we're nurturing our babies. So the more we nurture our babies, the more brain changes we seem to have in our emotional brain areas.
As parents.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, thank you for sharing your experience with your childhood and children. I think I've heard that a lot with seconds. And I think
there are lots of factors, but it was very stark. The contrast was very stark.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think a lot of it is the unbelievable pressures that we have as humans in the modern world, right? It's nurturing takes so much mental and physical energy and resources. And you know, I hear your experience a lot. And I also hear a lot of experience of people who have one child and nurture them and then are okay having one child. And they sort of
make totally
too.
Yeah, I've got a lot of friends in that camp. Then there's some, I don't want to diminish it. So I want to refer to it correctly, but like anecdotal wisdom, I suppose, that comes from the tradition I'm a part of, which is Ayurveda, which is one of the ways to sort of heal is to have another baby, right. To have, you know, a reparative experience when you are in this supple place.
Yeah.
And of course, giving yourself time. I didn't have much time between my first two children. They're exactly 18 months apart. Mm. And so again, there's lots of factors. Yeah. There was less support. My daughter was on my body nonstop. And I had an 18 month old and it was like, you know,
babies. Yes.
Again, like I couldn't do that. I don't think anyone can do it on their own. And you speak to that really beautifully. And I think this book is going to be a critical piece for expanding the conversation, but also like, how do we push this towards policy? How do we get this research where it's most needed? Because that's where so many still look for guidance, right? Yeah. Like it is. I'm very privileged to have this book in my hands the way that I got it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So how do we make this, you know, the most accessible? Well, it does have to be sort of handed down from the powers that be who dictate so much of the education that so many are getting.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I love that idea. I think if people would put effort where they put their words, mm-hmm. it would make a big difference. We, you know, so many say we care so much about families, we care so much about health and well-being, even on those policy levels, right? Governments say this.
Yes, totally.
And we really do need to start investing significantly, right? In families, in supporting them in these 3 years, because right now the state of it is, you know, we're usually, you know, having a similar experience to what you had, right? Where, you know, I was mostly sole caregiver of my son as well. And I, yeah, completely got depleted in so many ways. I was sort of able to show up for a lot of the important parts.
Yeah.
But really, really, really was depleted in so many other ways because of the lack of support.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's these layers of nurture that you write about. Like, it's not just, you know, be a stellar parent. And I appreciate that you acknowledge, like, this is not about being the perfect mother. This is not another book, like, telling you what you're doing wrong. It's just putting in context the significance of being present and well cared for as a parent, and considering all that that requires. And it's not only like you need to hire someone or pay for someone, but like the family unit, consider what a big undertaking it is to have a child, how significant those early years are, and adjust accordingly. And I mean, I want to put this out there. I had a lot of reactions while reading your book because I didn't have what I needed when my daughter was born. And I feel like, great, now what do I do? You know, like, I went to that place, like, well, okay, I messed up. So now what?
Yeah.
And there's so much tenderness in this information. Like, it was tenderizing to read this book, and coming back to it, you know, because we didn't get to talk right away, I've been able to come back to your book several times.
That's great.
And like, just feel into different layers. And it's so rich. I know I used the word dense before, and it's rich.
Thank you. Thank you for taking the time to reflect. Yeah. I appreciate it. Yeah. Yeah. It was like I had a microphone. And I felt like I had, you know, this one chance to really say it all, really, to really reach the families who need to know, right? Need to know some truths.
So I have, this was something that I really wanted to talk to you about, and it's also been a theme in my recent podcast episodes, but I'm really interested in and curious about this experience of postpartum rage. Mm-hmm. And some part of me, I wonder if some part of it is the information that we've always had as women, as mothers, as wise women, as sisters, as caregivers, like, has been taken out of our hands, out of our bodies. And there's this like aimless anger. And so much of our experience of becoming parents is dictated by external systems that just want, you know, to profit, or, you know, without going down that whole rabbit hole.
Yeah.
But I'm curious about this, you know, looking at the bigger picture of the downstream consequences of when we aren't able to have the necessary layers of care. You know, in terms of this book and all the information that you impart, what is your vision for how this starts to seep into culture? Like, where do we start?
Yeah.
Do we start building those layers of nurture?
Yeah. Yeah. I think so much of the rage, from my own experience, which I experience still do sometimes. Yeah. And the parents I work with does come from this total lack of support, of being seen, acknowledged.
Yeah.
You know, we're like, I'm out here doing all this emotional work, all this invisible work, and no one's filling up my water. No one's asking me how I'm doing. No one's doing any, you know, kindnesses for me and putting energy into me as I'm pouring out energy to take care of my baby and family. And, you know, I think it's possibly starts within families and friend groups. If we could all understand how important this time is for parents and babies, mothers and babies, we could really start to be called in to that experience. And it is amazing. So many of the parents I work with, even if their parents do live in the same city, they experience these systems of sort of, you know, push the baby out, put them in the nursery,
yeah,
you know, keep them away, make sure, you know, get on a diet right away. Don't worry about breastfeeding, you know, all this kind of stuff that was going on for them.
Right.
And I feel like that's kind of being put on to parents now too, which is like, just get on with it. Like we did, you know, just get on with it. And I think parents are left so much more alone and resentful and full of rage when even their closest family members are not showing up in that way. And they're like, I've got an exercise class. I've got to see my friends. And they're like, I'm, you know, needing so much right now. So I think perhaps starting with educating families, I would always include grandparents in some of the one-on-one work I did. I was like, please, let's invite grandparents. Let's invite any nannies or anyone else around so we can really talk about this with everyone. And it's so hard in the systems that we live in because, you know, there's some grandparents who maybe, you know, and family, extended family members who are retired or do have extra hours, but there's so many who are not, who are still engaged in full-time work. And so are often a father or partner. And it's kind of very difficult, right? We really have to go and challenge that too, when we're trying to ask for more care and support for families. Everyone, it seems like in the systems that we have set up, everyone has to be working like as much as three people to get by.
Yeah.
You know, and it's really hard. I think a lot of that rage sometimes, you know, from the primary caregiver or mother, their partner, you know, for not helping more, for not, you know, supporting more, not giving them any time off, that happens. And then the partner is also probably working a full-time job and doing tons of stuff around the house. And yeah. I always will tell families, it takes at least three people to be taking care of one baby, let alone two babies, right? Maybe that's even more than three people.
Yeah.
And then we have all these people around, we can ask for help, but then, like I said, sometimes they also all have full-time jobs and, you know, other things too. So it's hard. It's really hard. Yeah. It's tough.
And I, you know, you write about this, to do this, the work of nurture. I mean, you call it a revolution. It is confronting. The very nature of this work is extractive, right? Like, and because so many of us are working against the fact that we didn't have it, or, you know, it wasn't modeled to us, or we don't have the necessary support.
Yeah.
And so there are a lot of layers to this, but this is such a critical piece for us to even say out loud, these structures don't work. Yeah. Look where, you know, the place we've gotten to where you can see our culture expressing such lack of nurture and care. We're unable to care for one another.
Yeah.
We're not valuing like the emotional intelligence of a child, but want to know like what they're going to contribute to society in terms of athletic skill or engineering capacities, whatever. Mm-hmm. It's just a strange, I feel like the tension in myself, because it would be so easy to just sort of follow along, even though I haven't followed along necessarily a conventional path. There's mm-hmm. still this like pull over here to drift into.
Completely. And I think even for this generation of parents to start to increase their nurturing, mm-hmm. we're going to be doing it in the systems that are set up, right? We're going to be doing our best to nurture, but that pull is so strong that it's going to, you know, change the way that it's probably going to happen, right? We're still often going to be going back to work, going to be not supported very well.
Yeah.
And so it's important for parents to have that message as well, right? To know that any amount is our best that we can give our babies, and that will absolutely be making a difference for our baby, right? It is, you know, I wish it was a revolution that could happen overnight. But it is revolutionary to engage with nurture in any capacity, right? Because we really are in these impossible systems for families.
Yeah. I just have this image of while, you know, giving to our children completely, you said it, like the doing the nurturing changes our brains. There is an oxytocin bath that happens for us too. As long as we have, it's like that next layer of support to hold us while we reckon with the resentment that comes up, the overwhelm that comes up, myriad of emotions. I didn't even know I had all these emotions.
Yeah.
And it's so worth pushing through. And I think in those earliest years when it's so intense and someone has gone back to work or mom is expected to go back to work, and what I found when I was doing birth work, it's preparing folks for parenthood is one of the hardest things. So you don't know what you don't know. And so many of us are just blind to what it is because we don't live together anymore. We're not involved in one another's day to day. Like we, for whatever reason, have been taught that we should like hide that from each other. Realness of it. So yeah, we've got a lot, we're up against quite a bit, but I also think there's, you know, these conversations are more prevalent, they're more accessible. Your book is out in the world. Clearly you've got colleagues who are, you know, doing research and sharing research.
Yeah.
I know this book was just released. So like, where are you in this process of getting your work out there, and how is that looking for you right now?
Mm-hmm. So I'm creating some courses that will guide people through the books, which is really exciting.
That's going to be great.
Yeah, I'm very excited. So the first one we had in a few months ago, and the next one will be in September. And then I'm sort of creating them and putting it out, and putting them out. So it'll be four parts. And then we'll see. I'm going to try to expand the ways that people can be supported, both by like with education and also some experiential ways too. Yeah.
That's wonderful to hear. I'm so excited for that.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. Me too.
Will there be a sequel to the book?
I mean, I am very curious about adolescence because that's coming up.
Yeah.
You know, a few years for me. So I think maybe through lived experience, like through research and lived experience again, that could be something that I look at. Yeah. Yeah.
That's thrilling. I'm really grateful to you for the tremendous amount of work that you've done and the way that you've consolidated all of this material for folks to take in. It's such a gift. I know I have a lot of friends who are birth workers and support mothers, and it's like this gem of a book to have in hand to just pass along to families. So thank you for all of taking all of the time, putting all of the care into it that you have.
Thank you so much. Thank you for reading it so closely and your kind words. It means a lot.
Where can people find you?
Mostly on Instagram. I do a lot of communication on Instagram as Nurture Neuroscience Parenting. And yeah, I'll announce anything that comes up there. And there's links to my website there as well.
Great. And I'll put those links in the show notes. Anything else you'd like people to know?
Oh my goodness. I'm just so grateful for, you know, everyone who's listening and engaging in nurturing, and I want them to feel seen and loved. And yeah, I'm cheering you on, always cheering you on. All of us are.
Thank you, Greer. This was such a pleasure.
Thanks. Thank you.